Welcome to Idle Red Hands, a podcast from Japan about gaming and gamer life. And welcome back to Idle Red Hands. I'm Chris.
I'm Wayne.
I'm Lyle.
And we have some more big news.
Well, yeah, pretty big news. I'm pretty happy about it. We had a couple of comments on the website. We had one on the Hardboiled episode from Chartrick saying, thanks for sharing, and it's always good to find a real expert. So that's really nice to hear. Mm. And another one on Cyborgs from Luca or Luca, not sure how to pronounce that, said, the purchases I make are entirely based on these articles. So, wow, that's really high praise. Thank you very much. It's always nice to get comments on that, and hope we get some more. Please.
Oh, so, speaking of the commenting, I guess, on the forums, but actually these two guys didn't comment on the forums. They commented on the episodes.
Yes. Right.
But on the forums is a request for ideas of what you'd like us to talk about in one of the horror episodes next month.
Right, because we're doing that month of horror.
Yeah, month of horror, and one of them's going to be a little bit more open than the other ones. So if anything that you want us to discuss horror-related, and I suppose game-related, feel free to put that on.
Oh, really, that goes open for any time, not specifically the month of horror, but that's what we're looking for at the moment.
Yeah. All right.
Not that we don't already have something planned, but...
Actually, if you want to comment on what we talk about this episode...
That's fine, too.
...or request...
Just call me up. My number is...
We'll check the forums. Actually, we're going to be talking about war today, which is a pretty big subject. So how we've chosen to narrow it down is we've basically broken war up into three stages. And actually, this is not going to sound like we've narrowed it down at all, now that I think about it.
And the three stages are?
Everything before, during, and after. well, the focus is we're kind of looking at playing in the different stages of war, mm-hmm. playing before or during the build-up, during the war, and, of course, the aftermath. And then we're going to have a little bit of a planned sidebar on technology and how you can use, you know, the kind of the marriage of warfare and technology, and you can use that in your game.
Yeah, I think a lot of games either, maybe not talk about, but kind of like discuss war, but maybe they don't put that much thought into what happens before or after, so... Just from my experience of sort of settings.
Well, I think during and after wars, they're pretty well covered in settings. You always have like the post-apocalyptic. I mean, that's generally an after-war kind of setting. And the during is that comes up every so often. The before war, the build-up too, is not as common though. Mm. To be honest, of all the three though, that's one I think I have the most difficulty coming up with ideas for.
Well, then perhaps you should listen to our own podcast.
Indeed. I will listen to what I say.
As opposed to normally when you do not.
Exactly. Just let it all flow out.
Oh, he's going to be editing that out.
Yeah, I'm sure he will be. So go ahead, Lyle.
Yes, so to start it off, before the war starts, so the build-up. And you can look at like the different causes. But one of the reasons why we wanted to talk about the build-up to war is because I think that is a time where the individual can really make a huge difference.
You know, history is full of examples of a few or one individual sort of ending up causing a war through personal action. So, yeah, I can see how, I mean, you've pretty much not hit the nail on the head, but that's a very good point that the lead up to war, personal actions do matter a lot more or can have a much bigger effect on the world at large. And so I see that as being a good area to mine for game settings.
Okay.
Because where you do have such a small, a small group of people, but yeah, it allows all the characters and the players to feel like they have an impact on the world.
Well, absolutely. It allows you to bring in really high stakes into perhaps a mundane setting. If you're playing in a real world kind of setting where, people don't have magical powers or there's no demons or dragons running around, then it's kind of hard to make a very large effect on things. But if you have some kind of where the opponents to the group, the enemy is trying to start a war, and that would have a huge impact. So you could definitely give really high stakes in a mundane kind of game.
Well, I didn't even really see it as the opponents are going to start a war. Like, even the players could start a war.
Yeah, why not? That'd be a fun game.
Well, I mean, there's definitely reasons why. I mean, it doesn't have to be just, like, an evil party that does it. I mean, sure there's good reasons for starting a war.
Mm-hmm. No, I think Wayne's right about whether or not it's you're causing the war or you're kind of triggering it. I mean, we can look at, like, something where, I guess you would describe it as evil, where, mm-hmm. Nazi Germany orchestrated that little event on the border of Poland just so they could have a reason for going to war. Mm. And the Romans a lot. They were very legalistic, or they kind of had this code of honor where they wouldn't necessarily want to declare war on a country unless they had just cause. So naturally, they would try to orchestrate that just cause.
Or like the U.S. when they blew up their own ship for the Spanish War.
Oh, yeah. Is that true?
Yeah. I think so, anyway.
It's true.
Actually, I'm thinking back to like my high school history, so it is quite a this way, but I'm pretty sure it is.
Because that's kind of brought up a lot with like yellow journalism. Mm-hmm. So like when you look at the individual causing the war, whether or not it's just or not, or at least you're giving your country cause. And I suppose we should say that a lot of times we're talking about empires and countries opposing each other, and that's why it's a war as opposed to a conflict or a party of adventurers going on. But
what a fun moral choice to force the player characters into. You have to choose between your duty, for example, sparking this war, versus, you know, how bad it is to start a war.
I mean, yeah, it does lend itself to a lot of moral ambiguity. But, I mean, if that war, I know the Polish example is not great, but if you look at like maybe the Roman example, if they are looking at all of these agitating neighbors and they do have some sort of agreements with them, but they kind of think, well, they're taking it too far or they're going to be a problem. And Rome would often assess like they're not a problem now, but they'll be a problem later. So we need to trigger some sort of incident, cause et bel, so that we can declare war on them. While the party or the small group of people that are there to trigger that by, let's say, pretending that somebody killed some of their border guards or whatever. I mean, it's kind of like a small evil for a greater good.
Yeah.
Or it could be to stop a war from happening. And there's a lot of different causes of a war. I mean, there's religious wars, war for war's sake. If we look at Genghis Khan or Tamerlane, you know, the hordes that would sweep in. And basically, it's kind of like a culture where war was kind of their way of life. They didn't really have the desire to create a civilization. They didn't have a desire to become, to get more agricultural land, their pastoral culture. But then you also have like politics involved. So there's all these different causes, and all of these could be incorporated. Like you could even do like a jihad or even like the Crusades, kind of the Christian jihad.
That'd be one way to do it, and kind of to give the players kind of like a moral dilemma, right? If they're all part of this religion, and then kind of like what Chris said, like if it's going to be a war of ideals or a war of religion, well then the person that, or the players would have to choose between their religion essentially and war.
Yeah, I mean, you look at the if you look at the movie Kingdom of Heaven, and they certainly portray the Templars in a very negative light, and probably a little bit unfairly. But there's that scene where the guy, or the newly crowned king says, releases the guy from prison and says, give me a war. And he says, that's what I do.
It's a pretty cool line.
Yeah.
Sorry, I haven't seen that movie, but
it's a cool line, but I think.
But that's a great setup, is give me a war. And if you're, let's say, a Templar or a Hospitaller, and somebody's like, give me a war, that's for the greater good. That's for your religion, because you're fighting the infidel. So you would give them the war, and you would cause some incident that would provoke Saladin and whatever.
So I guess tying it back to like the group, that's what the players could be, like the instigators.
Yeah.
The person the king comes to and says, give me a war, and you're like, okay.
But if you're playing a political game, then there's and I think that's where before the war can offer like really different opportunities and different approaches to how you play this kind of war game, as you could try to prevent the war politically. Or even militarily or violently, when we get that into in a sec. But even look at Neville Chamberlain, who's kind of like a dirty word now for, or synonymous with appeasement, which again is another dirty word. But imagine doing that, and of course maybe not having like Hitler and trying to like stop a war with Hitler, because, that would be a good thing. But you can set up, whether in your science fiction kingdom or whatever, and it's presented as science fiction kingdom. That sounds really strange.
You could have kings in science fiction. Wasn't there a king in Dune?
I know, but it just sounded kind of...
Or emperor. I mean, it
sounded,
emperor,
sounded
I
odd together.
Yeah. Space kings.
Space kings.
Space kings.
Space Hitler.
Oh, jeez. Anyway. Sorry, go ahead.
So in your science fiction campaign, or any era, really, where you could have... You know that when these two empires or these two countries collide, it's just going to be mutually assured destruction. Mm-hmm. Cold War. Preventing that kind of war, not preventing a cold war, but preventing a hot war springing from a cold war, I mean, that can be quite noble.
Well, if you're happy in playing in established settings, I mean, use the real Cold War. What an amazing setting to play in. Spies.
Spies.
That's the way I'm thinking.
Spies and a heap and couple of more spies.
And other spies.
Spy versus spy versus spy. Yeah.
No, well, if you watch the 13 Days, and that's like leading up to the Cuban Missile Crisis, mm-hmm. that's a pretty good movie. Mm-hmm. I mean, Kevin Costner's accent notwithstanding. I mean, but it's really tense and all the back and forth that you would do. The negotiations, the diplomacy that's involved, and a lot of people say, oh, I really want to play a political game. Well, this is your political game, stopping that war.
I mean, it's just such an area just packed with history. There's so much you can draw from and use right in that setting. So much fun.
Now, violently preventing a war, I mean, a lot of things you can do with that is a classic.
Assassinate
Hitler, yeah.
No, I wasn't thinking Hitler.
You were thinking space Hitler.
Cyber Hitler.
No, I was thinking Hitler's brain in a jar, all right? No.
I thought you were going out there. Okay, no. That's better.
No, I was actually...
He's really deflated.
I was thinking general terms. You know, you're kind of like... It's the classic go and assassinate the guy to prevent the war from happening.
Yeah.
And not necessarily time travel or anything like that. Just, you know, the idea that... You know, you cut the head off the serpent, the body's going to die. So, you know, just go and kill this king, this space king, and the war will be prevented, or at least forestalled. But
yeah, and to play with that as well. I mean, we were just talking about having a party that's maybe trying to instigate a war versus one that's trying to hold one off. I mean, create that as the opposition. Maybe you're not against this country. Maybe you're against another group that's trying to instigate a war. So you have to kind of play between the lines. There's a lot of ways to go with it.
Well, what do you think about the different causes? Like, what would you do with that? I mean, we touched on that a little bit when we talked about, like, religious or war for war's sake, expanding your territory, or something more noble. I was watching The Pacific yesterday, and in that particular episode, the captain's talking to the private saying, I gotta, every step I take, every man I lose, every wound I take, you know, I gotta believe that it's for, you know, a just cause. Mm. And people often think like World War II is like the good fight. You're fighting against a great evil. Mm. And this is probably fairly rare in history to find where you look at a war and you're basically fighting against a great evil. I mean, opposing the hordes, you know, Attila the Hun or Genghis Khan, Kublai Khan, Tamerlane.
Really? I don't know. The way I see it is if you go back in history to where there wasn't kind of as ready access to information as there is nowadays, where the media is much more restricted to maybe only what the government's telling you. I think probably back in the day, most of the wars were against a quote-unquote great evil. Because...
Oh, no, that's how they would sell it. Like, mm-hmm. I mean, the Crusades are a classic example. Or on the flip side, the Jihad, where they're talking about, like, the House of Submission and...
Absolutely.
And they would even have, like, kind of rules that they shouldn't fight other Muslims. Mm. But when you look at it with the cold eye of history or the historical perspective and you kind of look at that, but then a lot of times we still look at World War II as the Great Crusade.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Maybe we're not far enough away from it in history yet.
No, that's very, very fair. But I guess the point is, I mean, it could even be, you know, the noble, and this is where you get into like more like a fantasy game. A lot of time, you know, when you look at Lord of the Rings, Gondor's clearly good and... Mm-hmm.
Really, I think Sauron was just misunderstood. I mean,
I was going to make that same joke. That's good.
Beat you to it. But you know, nobody's written the Sauron biography yet.
Yeah,
I'm sure when stuff comes out, we'll find
when
out.
When the fantasy revisionists get their hands on it.
But actually, that kind of leads into what I was going to say, and about what would you do with leading up to war. And I think it depends. Again, I kind of hate to say this, but it depends on what kind of game you're going to play. Like, I could see a fantasy game being that kind of black and white, right, against like a great evil where you have to, you know, one side's clearly bad, the other side is clearly good, and this is kind of the good fight. But then I think if you kind of go down the scale to a much maybe more realistic and gray kind of setup, then that kind of opens up the available choices for why the war would happen.
Well, I agree entirely. Like, that is kind of the common theme that you would go on in a war. Fantasy war is usually like the good guys in shiny white armor versus, you know, demons from the pits of hell. But why not play with that as a thing? Maybe, you know, we were saying in ancient wars, the only information you got is from what your government or what the king or the church was telling you. Have it be. Maybe the orcs aren't evil. Maybe, the war was started by your kingdom for political gain or, gain of territory. You find out maybe they're just another group or tribe or something.
No, you could definitely play with it, right, and throw a wrench at the players or make it feel more realistic. But I guess if the players go into it thinking this is going to be kind of like a typical fantasy story, and then it's not, I won't say that they will feel cheated, but it could kind of be like, oh, I wasn't really planning on this, and I thought the enemy was just going to be this nameless, faceless bad guy who I'm supposed to hate. And now you're kind of humanizing them.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. Wouldn't work for a hack and slash group.
But, like, it could.
Or my suggestion, sorry.
But I think it's something, it might kind of ruin the surprise a little bit, but I think you would have to convey that somehow before you actually started the game.
Sorry, convey what?
The idea that...
If, for example, you're going to make it something deeper where you're fighting against demons and devils, but the demons and devils turn out to just be misunderstood.
Well, basically, I was trying to say it in a less comical way, but Chris is essentially saying, what I am. Like, if your players go into the game thinking it's going to be kind of very black and white, then if you do kind of show that the enemy, what they thought the enemy is, you know, really fighting the good fight, and hey, maybe the side you're on isn't all that good, then it could be fun. It could be, you know, definitely interesting and worth telling, but it maybe if you don't tell them, or at least give some kind of hint beforehand, you could run into some problems.
Well, I think it's more of a problem is that the players won't do anything with it.
As opposed to
that they're going to be like massively disappointed because they could just still, you know.
Hack and slash.
They could still, yeah, these hippie demons, you know, cut them down. Yeah, but if you're looking at, let's say, go back to the orc example. And
thanks for bringing it down a notch.
Well, yeah, it was less like black and white. It was like, I want to make it gray, but I'm still going to call them demons and devils.
You've now made it green.
Okay. Nice one.
Not really.
No, I know.
Anyway, sorry, your orc thing. Go ahead.
Like maybe there's a, and this is where you're adding not necessarily an element of gray morality or moral ambiguity. It's more of a political thing where you have the border. Like a border prince or a border duke is causing some problems for the king. But he happens to be in the way of an orc horde who are quite easily riled. So the party sent out to ostensibly, I don't know, kill some chieftain who they think is going to attack. But really what that mission is going to do is actually trigger an attack and cause the orcs to like sweep in. And of course they're going to sweep in through the border duchy, which is going to take care of this problem duke. Now, the players could figure that out. Now, if they're going to do anything with that, I mean, that's up to them. They can still attack the orcs and cause a war, and then you're basically now going to move into the second part, or the second phase of war, during the war, and what they want to do with that, because they still would have to beat them off eventually. Or you could find out, they was like, oh, well, what's this duke really doing that's such a problem? Should they warn the duke? If they warn the duke, is that going to be a civil war? A lot of different elements that you can do.
So it leads to war anyway. Probably.
Yeah, at least to war anyway. All paths lead to war. And I guess that brings up the most important point. If you're doing a war campaign, just make sure there's going to be a war.
That's always good, hey?
In other words, follow the king's advice. Give me a war. Give them a war.
Or you can make it really open and it's like, use that line, give me a war. And you can have a very sandbox game, and the players need to figure out how to give them a war.
That'd be interesting.
Well, that'd be fun. That's a really cool idea.
And, you know, I was just thinking, like, sometimes, when you give that, give me a war, and that's very cool in a movie like Kingdom of Heaven, and that's one of the few written lines that are actually cool. I'm just thinking about how bad
the
writing is.
That's what you were thinking. You're trying to think of other cool lines.
No, but of course, a movie can then just immediately cut away.
Oh, yeah.
And there might have been some more dialogue after that. Basically stipulating, oh, here are your restrictions. And the same would go. I mean, give me a war. It can't come back to me, the king, or me, the consul, that I've ordered this, of course, and get it.
So what you need to say is, give me a war. But we never had this conversation.
Exactly.
You did.
What was it? Complete and discreet. Was one.
That's perfectly acceptable in a medieval setting. The king is the king. You don't talk back or question.
This can't come back to me, meaning the king cannot be seen as the one who caused the war.
And you get into the motivation. I mean, I'm sure the Romans, I mean, they had their own internal code and their internal morality, but also if you're seen as breaking deals left and right, who's going to want to make a deal with you? Like, what other nation would want to make a deal with you? So you have to make it look like, oh, well, we're not breaking the treaty. We're responding to this gross.
They broke the deal.
Right.
They're the bad guys.
Now that we've caused the war by any means, but I will say it's still a very exciting. It would be a very exciting game to actually stop the war. And if the players do stop the war, don't just like, oh, and the guy, the dead body falls on the key and it turns and it launches the nuclear missile. And you're like, oh, what a waste.
Okay. Well, you could.
Comedy campaign.
And then everybody would be really dissatisfied.
No. Actually, probably in a nuclear game, you'd probably skip during the war. And go right to after.
Yeah, pretty much.
But before we get to during the war, actually, we want to talk a little bit about technology and its kind of relationship with warfare. And I don't think I'm saying anything too profound, but basically technology and warfare goes hand in hand. And looking at the history of technology and the history of warfare, there's such overlap. And as soon as like something as simple as we would think now, like iron. It's somebody immediately figures out how to use that in warfare.
Or vice versa, like something designed for warfare becomes regular technology. Microwaves, for example.
Right. Well, these are not the stories we want to tell.
You guys are engineers.
Give
Here's
me a
the
kitchen
weapon.
Appliance.
Make it safe, yeah. So pretty soon, from laser guns, we now have laser waves. Heat your dinner in 0.2 seconds.
And I think one thing that's interesting when you look at the history is that high tech always supplants low tech. As soon as you have like different technologies clash, it's almost immediate that the inferior technology is going to be abandoned or that culture is going to be wiped out unless they adopt the high tech. You know, if you look at even like Warhammer Fantasy Battle, it's like take knights and you can take chariots. Or you can have an army that only has chariots, or you might look at a fantasy setting where you have an army that's got a very Egyptian flavor, so they give them all chariots. But you're like, why would they still stick with chariots? Because that was an inferior technology. It was much less maneuverable than an actual mounted warrior. They would have to, like the Chinese, when they would have their chariot battles, they would have to like prepare the battlefield and even to the point where they're filling in ditches and holes, like what we would call potholes. I don't know if they call them potholes back then, but they
were in Chinese.
Maybe they just called them. I think they probably just called them holes. You know, to be honest.
So there's a role for your PCs right there. Fill in that hole. We're going to have a war.
Yeah, that's the really exciting before the war.
So much better than the last game where we made microwaves.
I was going
to
say like,
but yeah. Sorry to finish my point. Yeah. Sorry to cut you off. But basically, if you're going to have something like that, you have to explain why this one nation or this one culture is persisting in keeping this this technology. Because another thing you have to consider a lot of times in these settings, these countries are all kind of mashed together.
Mm-hmm. And especially the hand motions you're doing to indicate closeness. But
well, I think they understand the word mashing.
Oh, all right.
I just happen to be using for the sign language for the hearing impaired. And I guess I never figured out this is a podcast, not a video. You even have where there was kind of like almost like a Renaissance technology. And it goes all the way down to an Egyptian technology.
Yeah, when you talk about that, especially in fantasy, that you have different, not different levels of technology, but radically different kinds. I mean, you'd have somebody with gunpowder, for example, like the Renaissance thing you're saying, versus maybe some group with magic. Mm-hmm. And to pit those against each other, you have to suspend a lot of reality in order to think that these could actually be equal sides.
So I was going to say, no, I definitely agree that kind of like in real life, and if you're trying to make a game like real life, then yeah, whatever the superior technology is would obviously kind of take over, especially if you have countries that are in like close proximity to each other. What I think happened in like those games, like Warhammer Fantasy and other games like that, is sometimes it can be really difficult to differentiate different cultures. And if you want to make different places feel different, one of the ways to do it is to give them different levels of technology.
Mm-hmm. Oh, so, and they're also doing the classic, like, Robert E. Howard thing where you take real cultures and then you dress it up. And then, you know, oh, well, everybody thinks Egypt is cool.
Right.
So why should I reinvent the wheel? Mm-hmm. And I'll just have the Egyptian culture. Right. And people think Vikings are cool, so we'll have the Viking culture and we'll call them snow barbarians.
Right.
And ice barbarians.
So,
but yeah, I think just a couple things to consider. One thing is location. Mm-hmm. So the reason why technology was constantly evolving, and weapons were constantly evolving in Europe as opposed to like in other countries, because you had all of these different. It's quite open geographically, so you can have the Mongol hordes just sweeping in. Man, am I really bagging these Mongol hordes?
Well, I mean. Anyway. The Mongol horde sweeping in.
The steppe
didn't
people.
Sound judgmental at all.
Yeah, the steppe people sweeping in.
Well, I'm a big fan of his Japanese steppe. Genghis Khan.
Yeah. No, I agree, and I think
if you look at Egypt, Egypt actually like stagnated for centuries, deliberately so, where there was actually these technologies available, and they kind of stayed in this kind of Bronze Age technology. Because they actually could, all they had to do is close off the north and the south, and they were pretty insulated from their enemies. So you would have to have something like that, maybe like a geographical explanation why you have these divergent technologies. And of course, like the Native Americans and the First Nations people of North America would be a good example of that. They were isolated, and then of course once the Aztecs, they didn't have iron for. Even I think in the 16th century, they still didn't have iron. And of course, when the
conquistadors
came in, they just swept them.
Yeah, right. That carries even into a modern setting. Like here we are in Japan, where the whole Meiji Revolution started because Tokyo Harbor got bombarded by British ships, and there was nothing they could do but sit and watch.
No, I think that's a good.
Isn't that Commodore Perry?
No, Perry came before that.
Yeah. He opened up like the blockade.
Opened up. He
opened his treasure. Okay. Yeah.
No, it was the point when they said, "Holy crap, we got to get some of these guns and stuff."
And the funny thing there is they actually had guns. And they're a good, I think it's an excellent example that you bring up, because they're similar to Egypt in that they had guns until the early 1600s. And they actually kept them after that, but they restricted them so much that the skills were lost. But they made a conscious decision in order to kind of keep the samurai class in its elevated position to basically... suppress technology. But yeah, they were geographically isolated. They could do that.
I'd heard it before, this similar thing in Europe that, I don't remember the actual story, but it was that muskets took a long time to be adopted among forces because they were seen as really dishonorable for a long term. It had something to do with a group of musketeers. They kind of surrounded a group of knights and just kind of filled them full of bullets. And so it was kind of very dishonorable action, so they got a bad rep for a while.
Well, even the Hundred Year War, I mean, when you look at that, was the first time anybody outside of the British Isles saw what a longbow could do and how it could punch through armor. I mean, it was still considered dishonorable, but if you look at the force compositions, they would be like the British, the English would have 1,000 men at arms, and by that we would think like kind of knight, and 5,000 archers. So if they have like an army of 6,000, I mean, we're looking at like a huge ratio differential. And that's just because, sure, it's dishonorable, but it's winning you the war.
Exactly. Yeah, that's exactly
what amazed me is when you read the stories is like when the French pretty much lost most of the battles until the very end. That's 100 years of losing, by the way. But when they actually would like win a battle, you would think, grab all those longbows.
Yeah.
But the problem was what I imagined. It you need such skill, and basically you need to dedicate a lifetime to learning how to use the longbow. That just grabbing the longbows wasn't like just grab some guns or just grab some missiles and use that. So yeah, I think it was always considered dishonorable. But I think there's few examples of where they deliberately but there are some examples, like in Egypt, where the Mamluks, I think that's how you pronounce it, but basically they were Muslim slave soldiers, and they were amazing horsemen. They're like the samurai in Japan. Their position in society depended on them being the preeminent warriors. And of course, when you give a musket to just anybody, and they now can take down a knight, while they can take down six knights. then that's a little bit hard to take. So in Japan, they shut it down, but Egypt couldn't do that.
Mm.
They tried, and they would just get wiped out by slave soldiers.
Mm-hmm.
Or sorry, they actually got wiped out by other slave soldiers who happened to be using muskets.
Mm.
Yeah. So the knights never liked it, but the knights had a lot rougher time, and cavalry has always had this funny position. But the nobility were the cavalry, and they didn't want to be musketeers, or they didn't want to lower themselves to that. So they would try to find other roles that they could play, and even though they weren't doing much on the battlefield, they would still have a higher status.
Force themselves in there.
Think of it as kind of odd, because cavalry remained a viable force. I mean, they were still using it in the American Civil War all the way in the 1800s, even into the 1900s. Poland, well, that was kind of
World
weird.
War. World War One had cavalry.
Absolutely, yeah. That was, of course, then it went all the way into World War II when the Polish tried to go against tanks, and that didn't work so well. But anyway, it's surprising that the
didn't
nobles
work so well in World War One either.
It's surprising that the nobles were so resistant to adapting to this new technology.
It was tough to adapt the firearms to the horse.
Because you pretty much would have to stop when it fired, wouldn't you?
Yeah, I suppose the technology of those days, we'd have to front load the weapon that would be hard to use on horseback.
Yeah.
Well, I'm also imagining kind of what Lyle said. Like, if kind of this is their place, and the way to adapt to the technology would be to lower yourself to common soldiery.
Yeah, that's a really good point.
Then it's like, no, I'm not that.
Hmm.
So
yeah, I've trained my whole life to use this sword. I'm going to use this sword.
Yeah. So
pretty dumb, actually. If you're thinking of it as winning or losing the war, but
yeah, I agree.
I think if you're looking at it as an equipment list, whether or not it's a science fiction setting, a modern setting, or
fantasy
or medieval setting. If you're looking at the equipment list and go, yeah, why would I take this sword when this axe does more damage? Or why would I take any of these melee weapons when I can just have a gun?
Mm-hmm.
But in the case, like, you know, when you look at reality, and that, I think that would be really exciting to incorporate into your game, is just the political ramifications. As soon as, like in Japan, when the Ashigaru, I think that's what they were called, right? Mm. The foot soldiers,
right.
When they were much more effective, when Oda Nobunaga was using them in their firing lines, just like the Europeans were, and basically the samurai didn't have a lot to do on the battlefield, then once all the major wars were done and all the major fighting was done, then you can immediately see why then the ruling class would say, all right, enough of the guns, get them back from the peasants, and we'll walk around with our swords and train on the swords and the art of the sword. And I don't think it's any surprise that people still practice the Iaido, the, you know,
drawing and slicing.
Yeah, drawing and slicing of the sword. And you're like, well, how effective is that in battle?
Yeah.
You know, somebody who's just going to let you, like, draw your sword and slice my head off? How about I just shoot you down? But Yojimbo is a good example. That Kurosawa Akira movie,
right,
where there's Yojimbo, and then there's the other guy, I forget his name, but he's got a pistol. And he's a badass because he has a pistol.
Hmm.
And I thought that was really good story that they told, and I'm not going to tell any more, so please go out and watch
fantastic.
It. But they still show that's something to be feared, and the fact that there's very few guns, unlike a Western where everybody's got a gun, but there's very few guns, so one man with a gun is a powerful man.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I think, definitely something you could do, like you said, play with the equipment list and, give an actual reason why you would take one weapon over the other, because it's so either dishonorable or fills the class so well or has such a social stigma attached to it that no one would take it.
Absolutely.
And if you do, well, then you're automatically like an outcast or, you know.
And you articulating that is just making me think, you could even incorporate – that's a disadvantage.
Yeah.
Yeah, somebody's like, I'm going to take noble, great, and firearm – okay, you're now an outcast noble. What?
All you would take a gun. Sorry.
Yeah.
Sorry.
That's what happens. Yeah.
Actually, I've seen that.
It was in the Wild West. Wow.
I've seen that quite a few times in other campaigns, specifically low magic campaigns, where because magic is uncommon, it's considered a very powerful force.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a stigma against it. You know, if you're a magician, you have to keep it under wraps.
That's kind of a little bit like Conan. That most magic in Conan is kind of dark and
kind of
dangerous.
Specifically in Conan, like, magic is an evil force.
But
actually, no, the magic actually gets into the other thing. when I was talking about. One thing is like you look at reality, geography explains why there's like divergent technologies. And if there isn't that geographic barrier, then everybody's going to adopt that same technology.
Right.
But when you have like a science fiction game, or you have a game that has maybe superheroes or superpowers or magic, then it does allow you to play with it. And I think that's why like a game like Warhammer Fantasy Battle or Dungeons and Dragons and games like that, they can then say, okay, well, this Egyptian culture also has, well, they tend to give them undead powers.
Yeah.
Really play that stereotype. But they tend to give them like maybe a greater magical powers. Or perhaps
Barbarian cultures, the Viking-esque ones have really big, strong attributes and carry axes a lot.
Yeah, so instead of just them being somewhat taller than the
average citizen,
they're now like these Ubermen, where they're so significantly stronger and so significantly faster that they can overpower somebody who might have a slight technological edge. That's something to do. But what I say, if you want to do that flavor, then explain it.
Yeah, give a reason for it. And with magic, like, you could make artificial boundaries. Guns don't work beyond this point.
And Torrent does a really good thing with that, where they have, like, the different realities. And, yeah, you could play and it is. When you first sit down and look at all the character options, you're like, well, I could play this hard-boiled gumshoe, or I can play this primitive. What? Or I can play, oh, cool, a mystery man with the rocket pack. Or then I could play
cyborg.
Yeah. Cyber samurai. Why am I not playing him?
Right. And they're all the same point cost? Wicked.
I mean, it's just, but what happens is because their tech is so high, if they go to a land, a reality that has a lower tech, and if you're a cyber samurai, that's most other realities, then basically your tech could shut down. Mm. And cyber samurai, whose legs don't work, ain't so cool. But I was also thinking now that I'm just saying that, I'm almost trying to think about in Battlelords of the 23rd century. And they have basically like an alien ninja, alien samurai, where they have sword saints.
Mm-hmm.
Kinseis, I think. Yeah. Where basically their soul is their sword. And you're like, well, I guess the Jedi in Star Wars is kind of that. Like, how do you get away with that? So they went, oh, well, they have all these other powers, and plus they're hyper fast with the with their lightsaber. They can stop these.
They can block
blasters.
Bullets or blast. Yeah.
All right. So I guess what I'm saying is make it ridiculous. But anyway, I have something cool to justify it. If you want to flaunt the laws of tech, then flaunt them. But
and don't forget that that's a genre in and of itself, like the invasion story. I mean, it's more common in a modern setting with like an alien invasion, a technologically superior group coming in and attacking with very little chance to beat them. But you could do the same thing in a fantasy. Take a mundane kingdom that doesn't have magic, and a magical kingdom starts attacking. I mean, how do you fight against that?
Like the kind of stories you could tell with tech, you know, you have stopping the war, triggering the war. You could be stopping the other nation or the other culture having this technology, or you could be going out and getting the technology.
Yeah. And that's a real thing. The story about capturing the Enigma machine.
What was the name of that movie? Ends 571.
Yeah, where they changed them to Americans.
I mean, I'm not saying that's historically accurate, but I was just kind of using it as something to pull ideas from. Yeah.
Right, or you could be trying to stop the like the V2 rockets, or even imagine playing a group of Japanese trying to stop the atomic bomb, the Manhattan Project.
Yeah, I was thinking.
Or you could be the Russians trying to steal the plans. Or even something go way back, go really primitive, is...
Steal Fire.
Steal Fire, Quest for Fire was a great movie. But even like the Iron Techs, the people that could fashion iron, which was a very specialized skill. And it was only after the Syrians or... I forget which empire fell. And that kind of dispersed all of these specialists. But basically, capturing one of them so that you can figure out how to fashion iron so that's not brittle or doesn't break.
That would be
break.
A pretty good setup. Like, you're in charge of sparking this thing that either starts a war to scatter these people.
Ooh, you know, like combining a couple things.
A small scale skirmish so that you can actually capture one of these people to have a leg up on the competition. Or I was thinking, not nearly as exciting, but intercepting, well, it's kind of the Enigma machine, intercepting and deciphering codes.
Right.
Like I said, yeah, reaction, yeah.
Well, I mean, really, any
stealing
kind
iron and the atomic bomb, a lot more exciting. You guys no, it kind of... Before I got the communication thing out, I was like...
Oh, I'm sorry. Well, I didn't do that. But, but it was the Enigma machine idea. Yeah.
The story is, you know, the sneaking in, the doing it, and stuff like that. It doesn't really matter what the MacGuffin is.
Oh, I wasn't even really thinking... Well, I mean, yeah, definitely. I wasn't thinking stealing, because at least with communications, you know, like the communication is the thing that's traveling. Mm-hmm. I mean, I suppose you would...
You ever see the movie Firefox?
I don't think so.
Where Clint Eastwood has to sneak into Russia to steal the... I think it's called the Firefox, which is...
A cowboy?
Yeah, the Soviet Union. He sneaks into the Soviet Union to steal, like, an extremely advanced fighter plane.
No, I haven't. I swear I've seen that before, but I don't remember. Sorry, perhaps it was on TV and you missed the beginning.
But I was watching a cowboy movie and, you know, I get confused.
Yeah. But you, Chris, I think you mentioned before the episode about taking that to the level where, you know, you're looking at stealing an alien technology or something very bizarre.
Oh, yeah, something like Independence Day where they take the alien fighter and upload a Macintosh virus.
Yeah, I was waiting for you to get to that.
You bring that little step there, but... actually,
Macintosh didn't get viruses.
Oh, but this is the old Mac.
Oh,
let's not go that way. What was that other one? District 9 as well, where a lot of the movie was about capturing and using this alien technology.
Or
is that the right name?
District or buying 9? It with cat food or something.
Yes.
Yeah. No, that's almost...
A little different. It's definitely not a war scenario, but...
No, but it's kind of... It's sort of the same thing. Like, the goal was to figure out how to use this technology, and... Yeah, there wasn't a war, but yeah, you could definitely spin it in that, you know, like I said before, you kind of have to start a war or start something to get this tech. So I think that's a pretty decent idea. There's a lot of ideas you can mine.
Well, actually, now we're going to move into, because the sidebar has just become a bar.
Don't you mean a main bar?
The main bar technology. We're retitling the episode as we speak. We'll move into during the war and the kind of stories that you can tell. I think... The big dilemma here is, and Chris, you mentioned it at the beginning, is you've got a lot of people. You know, you got huge armies. Even if you look at ancient times, you're still dealing with thousands of people. Mm-hmm. Now, you can have skirmishes, of course. That's one way around it. But how do you basically have a small group of people, which is what is going to be around your gaming table? How are they going to tell the war story? Mm. So what are different things you can do?
I don't think it would be that's satisfying, actually, but one way to do it.
Alright.
I'm not judging my own idea, I'm just throwing it out there. But basically the players are kind of commanders of different parts of the army. So.
They're like a top down
kind of. Yeah, sort of like a top down. Like they're not the ones who are actually doing the fighting, they're the ones who are kind of making the plans, sending people off to do the fighting, coordinating the attack. And like I said, I'm sure that would be fun. You would have to kind of make it kind of like the beginning of war. You would have to make the stakes very clear, right? Like sort of play that political game so there would be some tension. Otherwise, I could see it as being kind of boring.
You know,
because all you're doing is essentially sitting in a tent directing people, pushing little pieces on the map.
I don't think that would be... sorry for jumping.
Is the word you're looking for unsatisfying, Chris?
No. Well, I think for a lot of groups, it would actually be pretty roleplay light because the generals or the people in charge of the army, they might not have that many interactions unless they're maybe in a political situation where some people are opposed to the war or something like that. But for some groups, I could see that being a really fun game. I imagine Yujiro would love a system like that where you have an interlude scene followed by a battle scene. And you kind of just move the pieces around almost like a tabletop war game.
You
could even do it where basically, where kind of like a game like Space Alert, the board game, mm-hmm. where you kind of do all your plans and then you kind of watch it happen. Like, do you see if the plans and the orders that you issued, do they play out the way you thought? Like a general staff more. More as separate commanders, or even like the Alexander the Great would get all his commanders in the command tent, and then they would talk about what the strategy would be for the battle. And perhaps he was a game master then on the other side. And I don't know if it's going to get too wargamey, this idea. I'm just kind of talking it out right now. Mm-hmm. But you as a game master then think, well, what would be my battle plan as the Persian king?
Yeah.
And then basically you kind of unveil your battle plans and then you see what happens. And you pretty much, either whether you as a game master make a decision that, oh, that's pretty good, they would have wiped out that orc army, or...
I thought we were talking about Persians. Oh, sorry, Persians and orcs are the same thing.
Yeah, yeah, I guess if you watch 300, yeah.
That's where I was going. Yeah. Glad somebody got my joke.
Yeah.
Me too, because that was going right over my head, but...
Yeah, I could tell.
No, we talked about that after we saw 300.
Ah, I gotcha.
It's like, boy, I you know, it's one of those things when you hear like...
Because I'm kind.
Yeah, when you hear like Iran is like, oh, they're protesting 300, and you're like, well, sensitive are you? And then you watch 300 and you're like, oh my God. Yeah, that was...
You're like, yeah, I kind of...
How could nobody not see that that would be offensive?
Yeah. Really? I heard it's really popular in Greece. Go figure.
Except for in Athens. Yeah. Boy lovers, what are the Spartans more...
There are a few game systems out there that have ways of dealing with mass combats.
Oh, good. You were going through mass combat, not Boy Lover.
Well, now that you mention it.
I'm going to jump onto that one in just a second. And I do mean jump onto. Oh. For example.
How did you just get that?
Legend of the Five Rings.
Yep.
Has a good war system. I know you guys aren't the biggest fans of the system, but Savage Worlds has a pretty good mass combat system as well.
And GURPS has a mass combat system. Actually releasing a book.
I've never read that one.
I will be ordering.
Cool.
And oh, by the way, since we talked about tech, and I know Lucca likes to...
Make purchases based on these articles.
What we recommend. I do highly recommend GURPS High Tech.
Mm-hmm.
I've ordered Low Tech, but I haven't read it yet, so you may get a recommendation later on.
Yeah, I haven't read Deepest Hero one, but I page for yours look great.
Yeah, High Tech looks... It is really good. They explain... The stories behind technology and the development. And that's what I really like about the GURPS system, where it does really break down at what tech levels you find certain things.
Mm. And just to reiterate, in case we have to say it again, Lyle does not work for Steve Jackson Games in any capacity. Nor
and I don't work
this.
For White Wolf either, but I do really – I really liked World of Darkness Armory.
Oh, yeah,
as
well. That's right.
That's a really – and it's a really nice read too. It's a very easy read when you're considering it's just talking about – guns and stuff.
They're way out of print, but they might be available in PDF form, but the cyberpunk equipment books were really good as well. They really fit into that world.
So that was cool. Good fun, yeah. Sorry, but I did cut you off.
Oh, about the mass combat systems.
Yes.
Yeah. Well, actually, you might be more familiar with the Lord of the Legend of the Five Rings than I am. You own the book, and I've only kind of just looked through it.
Well, I was going to say, you did one in D&D 4E, actually.
That one was a lot of fun, but it was really off the cuff.
But I guess I brought that up because, like, you don't really need, like, a system. I mean, it would help, but, I mean, if so long as you're creative and you come up with something, you could do it in almost any system you're running.
Just for the listener's sake, what I did in that game is we ran it as a skill challenge where the players would nominate a skill that would be applicable in the battle, the reason, rationale behind it, and roll that. And based on that, they would they would do damage to oncoming groups of enemies.
Yeah, and you broke it down into we had like tokens on the map that represented blocked troops.
Yeah. No, I think I had beads and you could flip them over to do half the damage and then just take it off the board if it was totally wiped out. Anyway, it was just totally made up, but it was good fun.
Well, it worked. But I was going to say, I think, like, that thought got sucked right back in my head.
Well, since you talked about system, what you're thinking there, yeah. Right? Yeah, as long as, even if it's, however off the cuff or however detailed it is, I mean, basically what a system is something so the players don't feel like they're being cheated in what they do. And yeah, even though it was off the cuff in that D&D 4E game, I never felt like we were being cheated. So then, well done. Yeah. And it just shows that even a very, very simple rule. So if you have the Alexander versus Darius scenario and the players come up with this idea in the command tent, I mean, it doesn't matter what system it is. If it seems arbitrary and they're going to feel cheated no matter what they do, then that's a bad system.
Yeah, it might not be a good thing to do, huh?
Yeah.
Yeah, I've heard one of the things, I've never actually tried it, but it's always looked really interesting, is to have a like a scene scripted battle. I've seen it referred to before in a few different forums around the net, where the DM decides kind of this is how a battle's going to go. There's going to be kind of the first conflict, and then maybe in, for example, fantasy setting, there's going to be a big demon that comes up on a flank at one point, and then the wizard comes in and attacks. There's basically these different scenes of the battle, and the players can join into these scenes, and they're small enough in detail that it's okay for one group to tackle it. And depending on how well they do in this specific scene, that kind of directs the war, kind of almost like a flowchart kind of way. So if they defeat the demon, then they can move on and try and flank the enemy troops. Or if they lose to the demon, then they have to maybe go back and help defend the city against it or something like
that. So essentially what it is, it's a bunch of linked scenarios.
Exactly.
That take place during the war. Kind of like, almost like a Warhammer 40,000 campaign a little bit. Where what you do in this scenario is going to affect what happens in the next scenario.
Except down kind of on the squad level. So the squad version of that.
So for that, I've seen that talked about before. But for that one, the people or the players would actually have to, I would imagine, be soldiers.
Well, no, I think player characters working for an army, you know, drafted into an army or just volunteer to fight with this group.
Yeah, but what I mean is, like, that wouldn't be the general. Like, if you set the player characters up as, like, these important generals or people who are kind of above the common soldiery, I think you run into the problem of why are they fighting in kind of this, not street-level combat, but what would essentially be street-level combat, as opposed to making the big decisions.
I don't know. If you're a king, regardless of how tactical a mind he has, man, if I have a guy that can throw fireballs and kill dozens of troops at once, I want him on the line, or at least on the wall. You know what I'm saying?
I know what you're saying, I suppose, but I'm just...
I suppose it depends on your story, really. You can find a rationale for it one way or the other, just depending on what you think the players would enjoy most.
I guess, but then you kind of get into the point, like, if this...
Or not.
Like, if you use your fireball example, like, if this guy is the archmage, right, and I'm not saying that the player character would be, it's like, no, your job is kind of to be here and figure stuff out, not be on the front lines hurling fireballs. That's kind of grunt work. So I guess what I'm saying is you kind of have to, or figure out, the players have to figure out, if they're going to be, you know, sort of grunts, elite kind of people who are making the decisions, or something in between. And then that'll kind of dictate what happens in the story.
Yeah.
I guess when you look at a war, I mean, let's differentiate between war and battle.
Right.
And I think this is where maybe the small-scale encounters or small-scale adventures can take place during a war. And basically, a war, like the 100-year war, doesn't mean that there was a 100-year battle. There was a series of battles, and then there was a series of things called chevaches, or kind of, it seems to me like just like brigands, where they basically would terrorize the countryside, the French countryside, and deprive France of,
You know,
resources and food and people.
But I thought
people are resources.
Yeah, there's a ch in that word.
No.
But, you know, it's not chivalry. Yeah. But, yeah, but so when you look at that, and even if you look at, like, a modern battle, I mean, what do they say? What does a soldier say? Hurry up and wait.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of time when you're waiting. And, of course, let's not role play the waiting. It could be boring. But that means there's just a lot of different stories. There's the scouting.
Mm-hmm.
There's even, if you want to do, like, the English in the 100-Year War, there's the, you know, attacking...
Helpless villagers?
Yeah, attacking helpless villagers. Not helping, Wayne. Not helping.
Sorry.
But basically small objectives that you could do. Saving Private Ryan is another example. Yeah, it takes place the backdrop of the invasion of Normandy. But once they're on the beach, they stop and they consolidate. And then, hey, let's send out this little party to get this Private Ryan because his brother's dead.
Right.
And those are the little stories, like the small-scale stories you can tell. And, yeah, I don't know if this would combine... These generals versus the small man. I think, yeah, you wouldn't necessarily in the small scale story send out your entire general staff to save Private Ryan. But, I mean, but that would be what it was. What I don't see in your two ideas is flip-flopping between the two.
No.
It would be either or.
Yeah. And again, like I said, it just depends on what kind of player group you have, what they would want to play.
I think that's what we were ineffectually trying to articulate.
I agree. Yeah.
But yeah, so basically, playing during the war, play in the gaps.
Hmm.
And in the gaps, you can set it up, I guess, like the flowchart Chris was describing, where what you do in these gaps between major battles can influence the major battles. I mean, if you look at a lot of times, this is certainly not new to wargaming. When they set up a series of little miniature battles, and it determines what kind of reinforcements arrive or what kind of reinforcements are available for their main battle. Mm-hmm. And it's the same thing that you can do here. Or you can tell entirely different stories. I mean, where you set the game determines what kind of story you would tell. Mm-hmm. Are you playing on the front lines? And I think that's what we've been talking about.
Right.
Are you playing behind the lines? And that gets your spy versus spy, assassination, just pulling in from our sidebar that's consuming the entire episode, stealing tech or preventing somebody from getting tech.
You know, you could play a really...
And the third one was the home front. But you could look at, you know, there could be spies coming into your country. Mm-hmm. So it's basically, you could play it as a flip of the behind the lines.
Mm-hmm. You know, I was just thinking there, you could have a lot of fun making an episodic kind of campaign with that, where you played the scope of a war, but you played different groups in it. And one day you played the people on the front lines, and another day you played maybe the people behind the home front. The next session could be the spies, and you could get into playing maybe the general staff as well. I think could be really fun too if you had characters play as the generals making the decisions, and then you had to take control of the people who are actually playing out those battles that the generals have decided on.
I'd almost be like you're kind of playing out War and Remembrance or something, like a book like that.
Hmm.
Whereas, it's World War II, but from all these different perspectives. Mm.
I think it might be tough in a more modern campaign because there wouldn't be so much variability in the characters. You know, you play a soldier on this end of the war, and you play a soldier on that end of the war. Sure, you can make different characters, but, you know, how many different personalities do you want to put to in those different episodes? It might work better in a more fantasy thing where you could play radically different characters.
I was going to say, like, a kind of a sidebar here. So if you do kind of these connected scenarios, whether you kind of, like, jump around to the different groups or, you know, the different locations. Mm-hmm. If you were a GM, how clear would you make those connections to the players? Kind of what I mean is, like, as a GM, you know what the connections are going to be between these scenarios. You know that if they achieve objective A or if they fail, then you know what's going to happen and what the consequences are going to be.
Well,
in terms of game mechanics. So, like, would you make that clear to the players? Because I think sometimes if it's, I don't know, it's kind of like a balance. Like, if it's not clear, the players, it might not be as impactful as it was,
I think
you made that clear.
I think if you were going to do that,
I'll just keep talking, because I haven't made my point clear enough, and...
I'm not entirely sure what you're going on there, but...
Nobody is. Myself included.
I think if you're going to do that, then you should make it clear in that if the players win a battle, make it important, make that actually give progress in the war. I mean, that's just something the players want to see, that what they're doing is having an impact, of course.
I kind of saw it as like the general staff would issue the orders, and it kind of depends on what era you're playing, because it could be an era where, I mean, if you're playing Greeks, the commanders would be right out in the front.
Yeah.
If you're playing Romans, they would actually be in mortal danger as well, as the commanders.
Well, the commanders would be fighting amongst the troops then, even.
Yeah. So, but, I mean, if you're looking at something more modern where the definition or I guess the role of the general is more behind the lines and doing the planning, then I was imagining it as the general would plan, the general players would plan, and then the soldier players would kind of be acting out what a portion of that plan.
That's what I meant to imply, yeah.
Yeah, so you would go top down.
Right.
I could see the connection being very clear. I was thinking something Chris suggested made me think maybe you weren't suggesting this, but you could also go, like, for essentially bottom up.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you start with playing the soldier, and then you could
Well, the soldier always gets his orders from somebody.
Yeah, I guess so, but...
Not that I guess so.
Yeah, he does. I don't know why I said I guess so. Sorry.
If you have to, sure.
Maybe I'm like, guess. Maybe. But, no, I was thinking a bit more like a scenario. Like, if you fail this objective, or even if you achieve this objective, you might not see sort of the bigger picture that happens because of the actions you took.
A soldier probably wouldn't, yeah. But the general would, which could give the players that kind of satisfaction. Hmm. Or the soldier might. Mm-hmm. No, I actually, you just mentioned it there about start with the soldier. I think that'd be fun. You know, start with a boom. Start with the battle scene at the beginning of the war and cut back to the generals later.
Can I just interject here to say I've coined a new phrase, clear as Wayne?
Clear as Wayne.
Which means not very or not at all.
Yeah. Well, but that gets into a good point. And I was just doing some reading, and a historian named John Keegan had defined, or kind of divided up the, like, fighters or warriors into different categories. And you, in a moment, you'll see why I was hesitant to say divided warriors into different categories. Because first category, warrior. Yeah, historically, you have a warrior, and that's your samurai, that's your knight, that's your Roman.
That's your musketeer.
Or
would that be something else?
Yeah. Then you have your mercenaries. And mercenary would be, as you can imagine, someone who fights for money, whereas a warrior fights because that's their position in society. There is the regular, which is very much like a mercenary, but that would be kind of like the legionnaires became at a certain point in Roman history, where that became their job. And they are reliant on, just as a mercenary is reliant on different nations for their livelihood, the regular is reliant on the one nation for their livelihood.
So it's kind of like the Spartans, what is your occupation?
They would be warriors, because that's what their role is in society, is they are the warrior. Okay. Then you have slaves, slave warriors, and that could be kind of like, I don't know, 300 Persia. Then you have the militia, where it's kind of like a part of their duty is occasionally when, in order to be a citizen, then you are going to be required to fight whenever it's needed.
Early Rome.
Actually, early Rome, that would be what the legionaries were before they became regulars. And then there's the conscript, which is kind of like a tax you would put on somebody's life. You conscript them or draft them.
Yeah. So you can't pay off this tax, which means you got to join the army.
Out of curiosity, what would you put modern soldiers, say an American?
Regulars.
I was wondering about that, because a regular, you say, has that, but it's a volunteer force, and they sponsor kind of such a brotherhood, warrior kind of spirit to it. Isn't it kind of floating in between?
Regular, even a mercenary has kind of a camaraderie amongst each other. But a regular, like John Keegan had said that they're very much like mercenaries, except their pay is coming from their nation, as opposed to their pay is coming from whatever nation can afford to pay them. So, yeah, that's what it was. I mean, at one point, when the legionaries first started, they would be like a militia. Like every able-bodied Roman who met this requirement, if there was a war, they would be required to fight. Yeah. Then at a certain point, when a lot of slaves came in and took up all like the agricultural labor, then they kind of had like all these poor plebeians. So then they said, okay, we'll make it like a job. So you think of like a regular, like if being a soldier is like a job, that's a regular. And most modern armies, it's a job.
Whereas if it's a lifestyle, it's a warrior? Or lifestyle, maybe, if it is your life.
But if somebody's a warrior in a modern army, or sorry, a soldier in a modern army, that's not necessarily their status in life. They can be, you know, like us. They're not like, whereas a knight or a samurai, that was actually, that society had a specific class of people, like a warrior.
I see. So like warrior would almost be like kind of like your status or your rank outside of the army. You know, like there's a
Yeah, there's I guess that would be a good way of putting it. Hmm. Yeah. So you could have
very clear, Wayne, thank you.
Well, I didn't think mine was unclear. I don't think mine was as clear as Wayne's.
that's not a compliment.
I know. Yeah. No, but if you look at a medieval army, that would be not made up of only warriors. It would be made up of warriors and, I would imagine, conscripts. Yeah. Just people that they drafted for that specific battle.
Right.
And it was only until, like, actually, again, the Hundred Year War, where you start to see some semblance of a modern state troops where they, like a standing army. Had that, then the French started beating the English because they started adopting what? Kind of the regulars.
So I guess then musketeers would be kind of like regulars.
I suppose they would. I don't know too much about the musketeers. So when you first said it, I wasn't latching on to that they are a warrior class.
Maybe there's a little bit of warrior in there, because they were sort of part of this state-sponsored force.
Mm-hmm.
Their wages came from, you know, the king. And, you know, that kind of was their job. They were sort of
Well, they went to different schools, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
But then they were also kind of outside of the army. People would say, oh, there's a musketeer, and would act differently around him.
That sounds like warrior. It sounds like a different class then.
Maybe it's kind of a blend of warrior and
it sounds like there is a little bit of gray between each of these definitions, but...
Once again,
except for the modern army, it's still regular. Don't try to work in your modern army thing.
I think I was right. I don't know what you meant, but
I'll give musketeers, but not. If you kind of think of this, and some of these are more helpful than others, because I don't think anybody's going to want to play a slave.
That could be interesting, Spartacus.
Yeah, exactly. But because these slaves weren't necessarily drafted in as soldiers, because Romans didn't use slave soldiers. Mm. They eventually had foreign soldiers and stuff like that. Things broke down. But those slaves were just actually slaves. Agricultural slaves. They were gladiatorial slaves. Mm. I think. But if you could do it I'm not saying you can't do a slave story.
Right.
But if you're basing it around your slave soldiers, then I guess if the story is, hey, let's not be slaves anymore.
Yeah, let's go join the other guys.
I was thinking the story could be, hey, let's not be soldiers anymore. Let's just be slaves.
Some slave soldiers, when I was talking about the Mamelukes, they end up getting a warrior. And here is some gray, because they would become a warrior class on their own.
Mm-hmm. Just to throw in a Game of Thrones reference, the Unsullied.
The Unsullied, yeah. Games like BattleTech, or they make a lot of use of the mercenary idea, because you can have a small company as mercenaries, and then you hire them out, and then and of course, who's going to hire a mercenary? I mean, you could hire a mercenary to do garrison duty, of course, but generally, a lot of times you would hire them for the action.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So you're always going to go where the action is hottest.
I hadn't thought of that, but that's a really good way to combine what Chris and I were kind of coming to loggerheads about, which was, the leader of the army versus the people doing the grunt work.
Yeah.
And the mercenary company kind of blends those because, they're these, I guess, kind of relatively small groups. Mm-hmm. So whoever leads them...
Not necessarily. Mercenaries can be enormous. The entire Swiss army was a mercenary force.
All right. I was trying to put our two ideas together. You just smashed that like nobody's business. All right.
Sorry.
Never mind.
Not necessarily so.
Yeah. You don't have to look at every example of a mercenary group. Yeah. Obviously, if your mercenary consists of three people, realistically, you're not going to get hired.
You two fight. I'm just kicking back here in the tent.
Can I be the general today?
No.
Can we afford the Swiss Guard? All five of them? I don't know.
And you could also play with the different groups in the same scenario, the same war. I mean, you look at a modern version now, there's a lot of consternation between the U.S. Army and the, what are they called, Blackwater?
Is that the name? I think they changed their name, but I don't know what they changed their name to.
Yeah.
And they changed their name because they had to.
Yeah.
Changed name to what? Nice Water?
I don't know. It doesn't make sense. I don't know.
But you had that back in the Middle Ages and such, where you had outright battles between the national army and the mercenary groups that were supposed to be fighting alongside. I mean, that could be a lot of fun to play with.
Oh, yeah.
Out of curiosity, which one would you guys want to play? Which of those roles?
Well, obviously whoever's the good one.
No, do you want to play the good guy or the bad guy? I mean, between warrior, conscript, regular. Which one sounds most interesting to you?
I think again, typical cop-out answer, but I think it's...
Depends on...
Yeah, it's hard to say based on what culture you come from in the game. I think it's kind of pointless to say, I want to play a warrior when there's no warrior cast in whatever group you come from.
This is true.
But I think a lot of times in games, people tend to play warrior.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because...
And that is that's how they define themselves. If you pick a fighter or a paladin.
Yeah, you kind of want to be recognized.
Yeah, so.
So it's not, so.
Even if you're playing a more modern game like Vampire or whatever, and you make a more martial character, you're kind of seeing yourself as this warrior.
Right. Like a sheriff.
Among the, yeah, or like, yeah.
I was thinking the reverse of that, the fantasy example is, you're a fighter, you want to be recognized, for your skills. You don't only want to have the dungeon denizens bow down. I was trying to think of, you know, how to separate the fighter's job from who he is outside of his job. So when you go into the dungeon, that's your job. Mm-hmm. Everybody knows you're the fighter.
When you head back to the city, you're an accountant.
When you come out of the dungeon, you're just a regular guy. And
almost like a secret identity. He pulls open his suit and there's a suit of armor underneath.
Yeah, yeah. I was thinking just like, oh yeah, another guy.
I came across this really cool quote from one of the, I think they were called like free companies or whatever during the Hundred Years' War. And basically they're mercenary companies. And the guy's name is Sir John Hawkwood. And his quote is, "Do you not know that I live by war and that peace would be my undoing?" And I think that's why like a mercenary company would be pretty cool to play.
Pretty badass.
Yeah. Yeah, it's just like, this is what I am. This is what I do. And you could actually incorporate, I mean, a warrior as well could do that. But a warrior, I guess, like what we're saying, a warrior is still a warrior in peacetime.
Right, right.
Mm-hmm. Where the mercenary has to seek out war in order to get paid.
There is no peacetime.
Well, it's a pretty crappy mercenary if you're just like, if you don't move on when peace comes.
Kicking out a beach.
Make me a war for a mercenary, there is no peacetime.
Now, hey, now how about that for a campaign where you just play cool in the mercenary quotes. Company, so the mercenary leader says, make me a war, making their own business.
Ooh, that's coming together. And of course, like a mercenary company, I think it kind of transcends a lot of errors, a lot of genres. I think you can easily like take that concept and put it anywhere. Mm-hmm. And like things like a warrior, yeah, you definitely have to have a warrior class, but then that would need some sort of political system dependent on it or whatever, like a feudal system, for example.
I think there's probably still a reason why the term mercenary is used today.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely.
Because there still are mercenaries.
Yeah, exactly, there still are. Exactly. Like you said, it kind of transcends.
That's a good reason, yeah.
You know, transcends. Correct me if I'm wrong, they still use the word doctor.
Recently,
yeah.
Because doctors are still useful?
The hell you say.
That sounded a lot funnier in my head. I really expected laughter there. Sorry. So just to wrap up during the war, last thing we wanted to talk about. And again, this is one way to get like small scale combat or people making a difference, like individuals making a difference is when you look at war, there's a lot of codes and rituals people follow. Again, going back to the samurai or the knight, because they're classic. You have the Bushido or chivalry, the code of chivalry, which turned out to be not followed so much and actually was only around for a very small period of time. But we're going to talk about that in a later episode. But also just different rituals people had, like the Aztecs would have a ritual where they were all about, even the way they would design their weapons, it was more about wounding their opponents because they were so superior. They were so superior, they would outnumber their enemies and that they could actually develop this like ritual of getting captives for their sacrifice. So they would edge their weapons and it was basically their... They wouldn't necessarily have a killing stroke. They have a stroke designed to basically wound the guy in the leg so he couldn't go anywhere. And then you take it captive. And their ranking system wasn't dependent on how many people you killed. It was dependent on how many captives you had.
That's really cool.
Yeah, if you got like 7 captives, you were...
What, you got a goal?
You would get... You know those really elaborate headdresses that you see in their... I don't know what... I'm going to say hieroglyphics, but I'm not sure if that's what they would call them.
Murals?
Murals, thank you. That would sound better. Yeah, that sounds actually accurate. Sorry. But those people, those would be warriors that have gotten like several captives. Or you look at the fighter races and the amazing stories of like the Red Baron or Billy Bishop getting his own and kind of the respect that they had for each other. And, you know, if one of them, you know, they shot one down, but he managed to land, then they would treat him quite respectfully. And then just different things like that, because it can kind of scales down. The battle. And so the Aztecs would have that ritual, but it was all about getting that captive. So it was very much, even though there's thousands of people, it's one-on-one combat. Mm-hmm. The fighter races, it doesn't matter what's going on below you. It's all about you and me. The knights, or even like, there's even an example of like charioteers, the knights of antiquity, where they would kind of have a code, like the charioteers were above the foot soldiers, and they would kind of treat each other with a certain amount of respect.
Well, it's almost kind of like the, I guess, classic examples you see in either movies or reading books where, you know, the nobility kind of ignores the peasantry around them and purposefully will seek out other people of their rank to either engage in combat, to either take, I mean, if you get into medieval times, kind of take captives so you can ransom them.
Yeah, exactly.
Or at least, you know, you could, so you can say, I killed this guy, you know, I killed Lord, I don't know, Boltington of whatever, as opposed to, yeah, I killed all these peasants. It's like, what? You're nobody. So.
I think a campaign based on ransoming individuals, which is basically a nice way of saying kidnapping, might make your players feel a little sick to their stomachs. That's very true, is that, you know, you wanted to make sure that you brought this guy in alive because you can get a lot of money for him. And it became quite an industry in medieval Europe.
Yeah, wasn't that that was the big thing at Agincourt? Where the French nobles were going out to try and capture the English nobles, but the English had kind of given up on that, and they just tried and killed everybody, and a lot of the French nobility got killed because of that.
Well, they got killed because they charged a bunch of archers and got shot down.
Yeah, and also they went through a muddy field in armor, and they couldn't lift their boots. Anyway,
they got killed because they ran towards the weapons. But that also brings up a point. It was a lot of times when we talk about these codes and the nobles going fighting each other, a lot of times that didn't happen, where it was basically peasants would be taking down these noble troops. But there was the kind of that concept and that ideal, and basically what you can do is take the ideal and make it a reality.
In fantasy games, that's kind of a hyper-reality in that sense, that, you know, a lot of people do follow the chivalrous code, and if they don't, then they're the bad guys, and you have to go out and kill them.
Like, even if the code isn't, like, expressly stated, if you watch, like, movies, usually, like, alien invasions or any other kind of movies that have, like, wars in them, usually the bad guys or the ones that are seen as evil, usually there's always a scene like, they do something that's against the code.
Kill their henchmen.
No, I don't mean like the evil guy killing his henchmen.
The henchman code. No. We keep writing this code and he keeps ignoring it. No, don't kill henchmen.
I was thinking more along the lines of, you know, you have the scene where it's like, yeah, they even killed the women and children. And the implication is that's something you just don't do. And that immediately casts whoever did it in a very negative light.
Right.
So it's kind of like these codes aren't written, but they're usually there, and you kind of only realize it when someone or the other, one side or the other, crosses the line.
Yeah.
And I would say most stories use that as the technique to show, hey, those guys are bad, and we're right for fighting them.
I might differentiate with you on one small thing, that a lot of times I think the codes actually were written. Like, there were laws of chivalry written down, even though they were different depending on state. Bushido, the Hagakure, is an entire book on them. Even nowadays, we have the Geneva Convention. So I think that you can actually codify what is right and wrong.
Oh, sorry, I wasn't implying that you couldn't.
Oh, yeah, sorry, I just meant to add on to that. But.
And, both of you said something that wanted...
All right, well...
I'm splitting.
Flip a coin.
First, Wayne. Talking about the Agincourt is just kind of funny where... Where, you know, like the Henry VIII, where he's like, oh, we few, we happy few. But when you look at the history, it's actually the French were kind of stopping them from basically slaughtering civilians and stealing everything they had. So it was like, we few, we rapey few. And it's just like, the French were actually the good guys and then actually just got slaughtered. Some settings have gone so far, and Battletech's one of them. And I think Battletech did it so they can kind of explain, hey, if you have all of these super weapons, why even bother having these battle mechs? Why don't you just blast the crap out of the planet? So they kind of did this thing called the Ares Convention, which is like the Geneva Convention for Battletech, which
because,
basically says...
as we all know, Battletech does it better.
Yeah. It's kind of like the Geneva Convention, but better. Yeah. But I think that's really good because, well, in a game like Battletech, the Ares Convention is used to explain why people would bother to fight in... basically like modern day knights.
Right.
Mm-hmm. When modern warfare is clearly not going that way. We're looking at tanks becoming increasingly obsolete on the battlefield. Mm. So they're kind of explaining, oh, this is why we go back to that.
I was thinking, yeah, what you're going to do is clearly against the rules. However, the reward would be really big.
Yeah.
Kind of toss out that moral dilemma. Are you going to do whatever it takes to win this war or to bring it to an end or whatever?
There's a good thing for we're saying playing the generals, the leaders of a war, you know? I mean, you could take this action, but it's wrong, both morally and both by conventions. You might lose allies to it, but it could win the war. What do you do?
Yeah, what do you do? Or you could even do like where you have a cultural convention, which is perhaps written down somewhere, but maybe it's written down in religious texts. So if you could have it, you could even have it where you have two allied armies, and let's say against orcs, because that's our standby for this episode. But one allied army actually maybe has the same convention on what you do with the bodies. Maybe the orcs really respect their dead, so they want the bodies, and the other ones defile them and, you know, cut off the orcs' heads and put them on spikes. So that's horrifying to the allied army. It's like, you don't do that. I don't care if they're orcs. You don't do that to a dead body. You're supposed to allow them to take their dead bodies. So you could actually have a sides switching. It's a bit of a stretch, but just to illustrate a point where you can use certain conventions to actually cause alliances to swap.
Yeah.
And you can really play with that.
Makes a lot more, I don't know, not makes it a lot more, gives a lot more depth.
And it also will explain, you know, you always have a classic, okay, you're in a prisoner of war camp starting the adventure.
Mm.
Well, why am I in a prisoner of war camp if I'm a supreme fighter? Why wouldn't they just kill me? You know?
Yeah.
It's like, well, they won't kill you because you're a prisoner of war and they respect you as a warrior, so.
Or if you want to give them a little bit more, it's actually.
They're going to cut off your head tomorrow.
Yeah, no, it's like, actually, you're only hamstrung. They're waiting until next, you know, next week to cut out your heart. You know?
Oh, I guess you didn't look down and notice the wheelchair.
You're going to be sacrificed.
Yeah, has your character seen Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom? No? Kind of gearing up for that.
And finally, we get into the aftermath of the war and what you can do after that. And Chris.
Nuclear zombies.
Nuclear zombies.
So I was thinking when the entire country is hamstrung. I just can't get off it.
We few, we limpy few.
Sorry.
Sure, you could do like a post-apocalyptic setting. And I don't think we're not going to talk about that too much because I think that could be a subject in and of itself.
Yeah.
Just like technology was, but we crammed it into this episode.
Only one main bar per episode.
But if you look at, if you compare, let's say, the original Greyhawk box set with Greyhawk, From the Ashes, which takes place after the Greyhawk Wars. I don't know about you guys, but I think that made that a much more compelling setting to play in. And even just what triggered it, when you have like the Scarlet Brotherhood kind of infiltrating and causing all these little wars. So there you have kind of, you could have played that like before the war.
Mm-hmm.
And then there was the Greyhawk Wars, of course, and there's lots of battles. But then you have this really interesting environment now where you have some countries have been taken over, some where they're occupied, some where they're just destroyed, some are on the brink. Yeah. A hidden danger has now been revealed, and what do you do about that? Yeah.
I was going to say, it kind of makes, I don't know, it makes the setting more dangerous, and I'm talking in general terms here. Because, well, I mean...
More dangerous than a shooting war?
No, I'm sorry.
Sorry, I was a bit lost because I was like...
I could tell. Clear as wind. Anyway. So I'm thinking, if you take like a normal setting, yeah, you could have countries that are at war.
Yeah.
But then I think if you go to sort of the aftermath of war, it almost makes the setting more dangerous if you have countries that have fallen or been occupied or are on the brink of destruction, because there's going to be a lot of like shifting borders and shifting alliances and roving bands of warriors.
Absolutely. And like the chaos that would ensue from that.
The chaos that happens after the battle.
A demobilized army doesn't just demobilize just like that. Right. Yeah, you have bands, you have unhappy.
Yeah. Oh, sorry. I didn't mean to interrupt.
Yeah, go. Scenes out of a Band of Brothers after they capture Berlin, and they have all the scenes like just drunken American soldiers going around shooting Germans.
Yeah, I don't think I'd want to play that.
I wouldn't want to play that, but that's an example. I think there's a lot of different directions because there's so many aspects you could get into about that. You have the idea of rebuilding something. You have the idea of consolidating the power if you've defeated an enemy. You have the idea of maybe you've destroyed it and it's fallen apart and you have to pick up the pieces.
Or there's the idea you got your butt whooped.
Yeah, absolutely. You are the loser in that. There's so many different ways you could go.
Yeah. Now, I know a resistance movement. If you're talking about like a country like France where you get occupied at the beginning of a war.
Sorry, it's pronounced resistance.
Resistance.
I thought it was pronounced surrender. Sorry. We now lost all our French listeners.
Oui.
But you could do resistance after the war as well. And although Werewolf didn't actually do much, the German resistance movement after the war, or I think it started just before the war ended.
Was that part of the Werewolf mythos?
Werewolf is what?
I think it was the group name.
Yeah, the group name.
Oh, okay. I was thinking about like World of Darkness. Werewolf.
Took me a second to connect it to.
Oh, sorry. Yeah.
Werewolf, and they are leading.
Sorry, after World War II.
But what a cool idea!
Like now, what if they're? Hold on, werewolves.
That just makes it a lot cooler.
Yeah. The French Resistance?
Has.
Le Wolf.
Le Wolf. Yeah. Or you could even get in, we talked about political games, and we kind of dropped that when we talked about during the war. Mm-hmm. But then after the war, of course, that becomes another part of the setting. Or you could look at, if you look at the Nuremberg trials and whether to punish or to not punish, maybe you want to rescue somebody who's going to be punished and shouldn't be. Mm. Or if you have somebody fleeing, maybe the good guys lost and it could be kind of a rescue mission like the Scarlet Pimpernel.
But I was thinking it could be like, good or bad, you're the country that lost. Or you're part of the country that lost. And now it becomes a political game in that, yeah, you've surrendered. And now it's your job to make sure that you hold on to as much as your country and as much as your custom and as much as your way of life as possible from this sort of occupying force through political means. I'm kind of thinking of the current situation in Iraq a little bit.
Oh, I see what you're saying. Mm-hmm. Yeah, you could do a resistance thing. You could also have it where the war finished not by winning or losing militarily, but politically. Like, it was a diplomatic solution to the war. But you, if you want to play a very political game, you have to keep that going. You know, you have to keep all the different groups inside your country from starting the war again. You have to worry about what the other country is going to do.
Yeah, that would be good. And I was just thinking resistance, when you mentioned Iraq, you could just do the flip side, is you are suppressing resistance. Mm. And in, I think in both cases, whichever way you wanted to play the resistance, again, it gets back into how do you tell a small-scale story? Mm. And you're a small squad of people that are going to resist, or you're a small squad of people that are there to protect the population from these resistors who are bad.
You just reminded me there. Mm. I wanted to mention it earlier. It's more to do with the during the war. But if anyone out there hasn't seen the Band of Brothers series, it's a great resource to look at for a way to run a small group inside a war, because it follows a single squad throughout World War II.
Company! So,
company?
What are they, D Company?
Yeah, not a squad, I suppose they're a company. But still a smaller group than the entire battle, so check that out.
Anyway, I don't play very many first-person shooters, but what you just said about resistance. Sorry. I think that's why most of the stories tend to be you somehow survived.
Yeah.
Or you somehow.
It's a good excuse to throw hundreds and thousands of enemies at
you. Well, yeah, exactly. The story always seems to be you somehow survived, you're a pocket resistance, and, you know, the whole world is against you.
Either that or nuclear zombies. You know, it'd be fun with D&D specifically, with the 4th edition, how it has the 3 tiers for it. You could have a lot of fun going through the whole war with that. You know, the heroic tier is kind of the build up because the characters aren't that powerful yet, so it's not a thing. One, the paragon is where it's going fighting, and by the end in epic, they're powerful enough that they kind of
fighting gods,
or you can even
or in control and kind
to take it away from system when you're talking about breaking it up into
phases.
Which is what we've done for the episode, is breaking them into phases. But we talk about like the general and the soldier, as you can even kind of tell. Where the scale gets bigger and bigger. So you go like soldier, general for during the war. Mm-hmm. Soldier, or I guess like spy or special forces before the war. General during the war. And then after the war can be politician. But so that was war. I mean, this is our plus size episode.
Yeah, it is.
and we're surprised we could cram. We could even keep it down to this because there's just so many things that so many different angles you could take. So. Mm-hmm. And I think people deliberately try to avoid telling a war story. They'll tell a fighting story. They'll tell a combat story. But I think people kind of shy away from a war campaign in general just because of all the problems that it can entail, such as, like, how do you convey that scale?
I was thinking one of the other problems would be war is obviously dangerous.
Mm-hmm.
Like, kind of a lot of people have to die, and I'm just thinking, like, if characters, it's one thing to kill NPCs, but it doesn't have the same impact as killing someone important.
What?
You know, it doesn't really make things feel dangerous, but then you can't go around killing PCs left, right, and center, and have them play like a new person every time, which may be one of the reasons that people tend to shy away from war stories.
Also, it can be very morally ambiguous. You know, if you're doing the regular thing, you know, you're going and killing evil people. But this one, they might just be conscripts. They're regulars. They're normal people who just happen to be doing this job. Mm-hmm. And I remember, as I was weird, I played that Medal of Honor first-person shooter game, and it was the one in the Pacific where all of the opponents are Japanese, and they actually have Japanese people, like, yelling in Japanese for it. And it's just really weird to, like, do play that game at night and then go to work in the morning teaching Japanese people lessons. It was just kind of an odd experience.
I can imagine that.
Yeah.
See, that's why
I guess as long as you want to say, get some, get some.
Yeah. See, that's why I usually stuck to games like
conjugate this verb.
Doom. Yeah. Because you finish playing Doom, you're not going to go teach a lesson to, like, cackle demons, you know? It's not like, so, how you guys all doing?
Same thing with that Band of Brothers things, you know? When you can understand what they're screaming at when they're being shot, it brings it to a new level.
Yeah, well, that's some. If you're going to tell that kind of a war story, then I would say bring it.
Yeah.
We haven't really offered any solution to that. But as far as, like, yeah, no, like, people dying, and that's a part of war, and, you know, people dying that aren't around the table does cheapen it. You know, when you watch a movie and it's only Vin Diesel that's going to die in Saving Private Ryan. Oh, well, that's pretty early in the movie, so I'm not ruining that. Then, yeah, that's sad. I mean, you did a good job there. But then you're like, oh, well, if no one else is going to die, I don't care.
Yeah.
So you need to see, let's say, if you watch something like Black Hawk Down, which I think is one of the best war movies out there.
Really?
Yeah, that and maybe A Bridge Too Far are my favorite war movies. Oh, and Zulu.
Anyway.
Yeah.
This keeps top three
right there.
We'll soon become top 20.
It's interesting. Like, I like Black Hawk Down a lot. My my friend, he really hates it, actually, because he said how faceless they make the Somalians look. You know, it's just kind of the other people that are targets, basically, for the Americans.
Wow, you guys just keep bringing up new wrinkles as we're trying to wrap up this episode. And there's another thing. It's how faceless you want to make the opponents. Mm-hmm. So I think maybe we need to revisit this in a later episode. Thanks, guys.
Didn't intend to wrinkle things so much. That, you know, I thought it would be easy to you know, kind of solve. I guess not. What we need is a giant RPG iron. Hey, I got a laugh from that joke. All right.
Thank you for joining us for another episode of Idle Red Hands. Thank you also to Luca and Chartrick for your comments on it. Anybody else out there, please comment up if you have any other systems that work really well for war or campaigns that you've run that were a lot of fun for it.
Possible
love to hear
solutions
more
for the wrinkles I brought up.
I was just about to say that.
check us out on iTunes, on Stitcher, through DriveThruRPG, on the website, any of the other places, post in the forums, like us on Facebook. And, get a hold of us. Let us know what you think. Thanks again, and see you next time.
See you during the month of horror.
Dun, dun, dun.
9 We average 9 new titles a day. That's over 60 a week. And we've got well over 15,000 RPG titles online right now. DriveThruRPG. We'll be right back.
Idle Red Hands is recorded in Kobe, Japan. See us online at www.idleredhands.com. Music provided by Tripod Jimmy, and the song was Roadkill. Hope you enjoyed it. See you next time.